longer days, warmer temperatures, and less snow on the ground. It's exciting to think about getting more active after what felt like a really long winter. But jumping into sports and other activities without getting our muscles ready first can lead to discomfort or even worse. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Physical therapists Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum are here with great advice to share with us about getting our bodies ready for spring activities and a lot of other important topics as well. Lori Tyne Brody is a physical therapist and athletic trainer with the UW Sports Medicine and Spine Center. She's also the graduate program director for the Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions in Provo, Utah. Lori, always great to have you with us.
It's good to be here.
And joining her today is sister, younger sister.
Thank you for throwing that in.
Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, assistant professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison and a staff physical therapist for UW Athletics and Badger Sports Medicine. Great to see you too, Jill.
It's great to be here.
Well, we have a lot to talk about, and we will certainly be welcoming your calls when you call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email a question to talk@WPR.org or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show. Well, you know, I think any change of seasons, there are health implications. What kind of injuries do you often see as a result of people jumping back into spring sports and other activities too quickly or too intensely? Jill?
Well, I think a lot of things we see are just the rapid change from being indoor and then going outdoor. One of the things we see are people going into impact and a lot of joint pain and muscle achiness if they haven't trained appropriately. You know, the first beautiful day we get, whenever we're going to get it, a lot of people will go out and run, and they'll run 3 or 4 miles, and perhaps they've been training inside. But just that change in surface is enough to make their joints and muscles really sore.
Right. And even though it's getting nicer out and winter's not over, just for the record, for example, early morning runners, there's still icy patches out there. So you have to be very careful. In fact, one of my kids asked me the other day, why are people running on the street when there's sidewalks? And I said, it's because the sidewalks are icy. They're uneven. There's cracks. There's water that collects. There's that thin glaze. So people really still need to be careful when they get out there. And as Jill said, if they've been training indoors, perhaps they haven't been running hills. Maybe they've done a little incline on the treadmill, but they're not running downhill, which is the part that really makes you sore. It's the downhill part.
Oh, why is that?
Because of the kind of muscle contraction that happens when you run downhill. It's an eccentric or a lengthening contraction, and it's the kind that gives you delayed onset muscle soreness. So usually your quads and your calf muscles get it. So that's a big piece of it. And also there's subtle slopes to the road and to the sidewalks to help with drainage. And that subtle shift can really throw some people off.
Also, I think, Jill, even if we've been using a treadmill, once you're outside, you don't have, for instance, you can't set the speed. And
that's right.
So it's a lot harder to know if you might be running 30% faster.
That's
than
exactly
you were in the
right. That's exactly right. It's much more difficult to control your pace and your steps per minute, which can also become a problem. A lot of people have a tendency to start striding out a little bit more, which research has shown can actually be problematic. It's actually better to take more steps per minute when you run.
So when you say striding out, it's lengthening our stride.
Yes, exactly. But there's some good evidence coming out that's taking more steps per minute, increasing your cadence, but keeping the pace the same is actually better for your joints and your muscles.
Why would that be?
It has to do with the mechanics, and if the farther your foot is in front of you, the farther behind you is your center of gravity. So all your muscles and joints get loaded more because of the lever arms. It's kind of a biomechanical thing.
Wow. So it sounds like for everyone, whether we've been doing things indoors or not, you know, better to ease into it. What are some good guidelines to keep in mind as we get ready for spring activities or start working our way into it?
Well, a lot of people say a very good rule of thumb, if you're going to increase activity or increase mileage, is the good rule of thumb is to increase by 10% per week or 5% per day. So a lot of people may have a really good cardiovascular base because they've been working out at the gym, they've been biking in a spinning class, or been running on a treadmill, but they should slowly transition their running program outside. So they may want to start by running maybe half of it outside, mm-hmm. and then slowly increase that distance by 5% a day or 10% a week. Those are good rules of thumbs for people to follow.
And so it sounds like if there's a date that there's an event
yes.
that they know they want to take part in, they can do the math and go backwards. Mm-hmm. And even, yes. I'm guessing it wouldn't hurt to spread it out even more if you have the time.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Right. And if you really want to get outside and it's so beautiful and you've been running, you might incorporate some walking mm-hmm. as part of that as another way to transition.
Exactly.
And does it matter if it's going back to an activity that we do maybe every spring or if it's our first time trying it? Are there different things to keep in mind?
Well, I would say if it's something that your body is used to and accustomed to and is done every year, the transition will be much more quickly as opposed to the first-time runner. This is going to be my first spring doing a running program. That person should actually transition much more slowly. So it does make a difference if you're truly a novice or an mm-hmm. experienced individual.
And we talked a little bit about maybe we've been running indoors and now we're going to move it outside. What if we've been doing very different activities, say maybe cross-country skiing during the winter, but now we want to start running? Is that a help?
As Jill said, it helps with your cardiovascular base. When you think about an activity, you can think about the cardiovascular demands. How much wind does it take? Do you have the wind and the cardiovascular infrastructure to do that? And they may do that. But the other piece is the musculoskeletal and demands, including joints and muscles. So the musculoskeletal demand is very different, then you still have to ease into it, despite the fact that you have the cardiovascular base to accomplish it.
And any particular advice for older folks, especially in the winter? I know a lot of older people are really nervous about those icy sidewalks and may not have, say, a gym membership or access to an indoor facility. Jill, anything in particular for people that really probably haven't been as active during the winter?
Right. Well, I would encourage them to start very slowly. It's so hard when it's nice out because you just want to put in that long walk. But actually to do a couple short walks would probably be better for them. And of course, pay attention to how you feel the next day. If you're a little sore, you know, maybe take that day off and then slowly transition and perhaps start with an every other day program until you can work your way into doing it on a daily basis. And like Lori said, you still need to be very cognizant of puddles and ice and things like that. So if you can walk midday when the sun is out and things are melting, that's a great strategy.
Well, and I've noticed a lot of sidewalks and streets have huge holes and cracks because mm-hmm. of that, yes. the heaving mm-hmm. and everything. So mm-hmm. that's something to
yeah.
keep an eye on.
Yeah, definitely.
What about for people who might be pretty significantly overweight, Lori? You know, I think spring is, you know, we want to, it's a new dawning of a new day.
Yeah.
Same basic advice.
Same basic things, except you do need to use caution, particularly in an impact or weight-bearing activity, because every pound of body weight is 2 to 3 pounds across your knee in a walking activity. If you begin running, then those numbers increase even further. If you have any biomechanical malalignment, say you're overweight and are somewhat bowed-legged or knock-kneed, that will also increase your risk factors for an injury. So you need to work your way into that slowly and carefully.
And we've talked mostly about running and walking, but biking also a good option.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful option. And for people who have irritable joints or a little overweight, biking is a wonderful option because it uses your lower extremity as the engine, if you will, your nice strong legs, but it takes out the impact factor. Mm-hmm. So that's a really nice strategy to mm-hmm. use. And, you know, in Madison, we have beautiful trails throughout the city. So there's some really nice, safe places mm-hmm. to bike in Dane County.
Right. Mm-hmm. What about kids? I mean, certainly, you know, open the door and they're going to be out there. But anything, you know... Do we worry about them as much as us older folks?
Not as much. So usually kids are self-directed unless they're being pushed by somebody. So, you know, I would encourage people, especially if weight is an issue for you or your kids, is to get out and do things as a family. Mm-hmm. So every night after dinner, you go for a walk, you know, or, you know, if you have a pet, you get up and you go for a walk in the morning before school, walk that dog in an afternoon and then the evening, and maybe you go out and throw a ball or go someplace. But, you know, one of the key things I think is getting out of that environment where you have a tendency to sit mm-hmm. and potentially eat. So maybe it means you go to the park, mm-hmm. and it's to at least change up the environment some to, and remove mm-hmm. those temptations.
And kids model their parents. So they see their parents out shooting baskets with them, and they model that. So it's a really good strategy.
We are talking with physical therapists Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. Are you itching to get outdoors and get active? What's your favorite spring activity? And are you dealing with any aches, pains, sprains, or strains? Jill and Lori can help. Again, 800-642-1234. And let's go to the phones and Jan in Green Bay. Hi, Jan.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got an old running injury that for some reason just reared its head about 2 months ago again. It's just on one side. It's like the upper hamstring, but it's kind of in the lower left glute. And I was just wondering if you could give me any advice on how to get through this. I still run through it. I mean, I run like 4 hours a week, like an hour and an hour, and then 2 hours on Saturday. But it's like, I don't know, it's the worst when you start out. You start out and you kind of pull up a little bit, but then I can kind of get through it, but then I can always feel it's like a soreness or a tightness on the left side there. And I had it back, quite a few years ago, and I'm not even sure exactly how it just finally went away or what I did, but I was wondering if you could give me any help on something that might help me get through it or get rid of it.
Well, when did it, what made it start off again?
You know, I'm not sure. I was listening to you guys earlier, and it's not like I've been doing this program since last fall. I like run an hour on Monday, run an hour on Wednesday, and 2 hours on Saturdays. And I ran outside all winter and everything, and even when it was really cold, and so nothing much has changed. So I'm really kind of puzzled as to what made it come back up again. I've even, I've got kind of flat feet, so I've really got regular shoes, and then I've got some more minimalistic shoes, and I've kind of tried to get away from those and see if, maybe that's doing it, or I don't know. Okay. I mean, even...
Does it bother you any other time or only when you run?
Jan?
Are you there?
Must be my phone or something.
Okay, there you are.
There you are.
Does it bother you any time or only when you run?
No, it'll bother me like sometimes when I get out of my vehicle, like even just like in front of a store when you're going to... when you're just going to run, just across the street to get away before the car comes and stuff like that. it's that first little burst when you start running, that first little when you take off, that it really, you kind of notice it a lot.
Okay. Have you seen anybody for this?
No.
All right. Well, given how important running is in your life, I would suggest getting in to see somebody and have someone take a look at this. If it is indeed your hamstring, they can give you some specific exercises to help strengthen it. You could have a little tendinopathy right at the insertion of your hamstring into your ischial tuberosity there at your butt, and maybe that's why it hurts after you've been sitting in the car. It's also possible that it could be referred from your back or something in your buttock. So, having someone take a look at you and examine your back and your hip and your leg would be a good starting point so that you direct the treatment at the right tissue. There's a lot of hamstring activities you could do, and I could give you a half a dozen different ways to strengthen your hamstrings, but I'm not convinced just from what you've told me that it is actually the hamstring itself. I'd want someone to look at it and validate that. What do you think, Jill?
Yeah, I agree. It's commendable how much exercising you're doing, and I think the layout you have is a really good strategy. What's concerning to me is the fact that it kind of has flared up again without any mechanism of injury. If you had a sudden slip on the ice or something like that where you had to have a forceful contraction of your hamstring, I would definitely be a little bit more confident in saying, indeed, this is your hamstring. So I think, like Lori said, it'd be a really good idea just to make sure that your source of symptoms isn't your back and make sure that the exercises that you are provided are actually directed at the tissue at fault.
All right. Good luck with that, Jan. And you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, talking with physical therapists Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer today. Right now, we are talking with physical therapists Jill Tyne Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne Brody about getting ready for spring sports and any other aches and pains that you might be experiencing. Let's go back to the phones in Bob in Madison. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Judith.
Hi. Yeah.
Lori and Jill, nice to be on the air with you today.
Hi. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Well, I've got the PAC test coming up on Wednesday morning, and I have been pretty active during the winter with snow removal.
Uh-huh.
And so, but over the last couple of weeks, there really hasn't been much of that, so I'm feeling pretty lethargic. And basically, Wednesday morning's a PAC test. And
okay, and for our listeners, Bob, tell us what that test is.
It's a 3-mile hike with a 35-pound pack in 45 minutes, so it's just over 11-minute miles minimum.
Okay. And this is to become a firefighter, is that right?
We do it annually to get recertified as wildland firefighters.
Okay.
Oh, so you're already one?
Yes.
Okay.
I've done through the PAC test numerous times in the past.
Okay.
But I'm kind of wondering if I should be working out at all or just kind of laying low before Wednesday.
Well,
it's Monday. It's Monday, Bob.
Sorry, we don't mean to laugh, Bob, but we were, during the break, we were kind of talking about how we might advise you when we saw your question come up, and we were thinking about different kinds of training, thinking that this was something that was months away.
but also thinking that he had not done it before.
So. Right,
so he's
exactly.
Experienced. He knows what he's doing.
Yep.
So it's Wednesday. My suggestion to you is I would do maybe some light activity today. To keep it low tomorrow so you're kind of saving your energy. Do some really good stretching tomorrow. Nothing new. I wouldn't add anything new to your repertoire between now and Wednesday because you don't want those muscles sore unnecessarily. And just kind of rest up and get ready to go. So something light today and kind of take it easy tomorrow and then go have fun on Wednesday.
Yep. Make sure you're warmed up well and stretched out. And
hydrated.
And hydrated. Yep. Yep. And being extra hydrated tomorrow, too, might be helpful to prehydrate. So
probably not too many St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, yes. Not the beers. No, not the beers tonight, Bob.
Sorry about that, Bob.
Okay. All right. I can go a couple nights, I
guess. All right. Good luck, Bob.
Thanks, Bob. Let's go next to Mike in Oconomowoc. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
I had a question. I'm 53 and I'm pretty active still, but I had, as a 20-something year old, I had hurt my knee. I'd gotten hyperextended playing outfield in the softball. A fellow ran into the front of my leg when I was going after a fly ball out in the outfield and got a partially torn ACL. Now, I was 25, and he didn't think it was torn bad enough to do a full repair on it. So what they did was they immobilized me at the time for 8 or 9 weeks during the hot summer in a toe-to-hip cast, basically. And it recovered pretty well, really. I continued to play basketball, run triathlons and all of that since then. But about 6 years ago, I had another scope done on that knee just to clean it out. And they said that the ACL was still lax, real lax when they looked at it. And gave me some exercise to do, which I did pretty well for quite a while, but then kind of hung it up. And I've noticed that I have quite a limited range of mobility with that knee. I just started taking a yoga class, and if I'm pulling my knees to my chest, laying on my back, there's probably a 4 to 5 inch difference almost between how far I can pull that leg to my chest compared to my other knee.
Okay. And does it go all the way straight, Mike?
Yeah, it does go all the way straight. It occasionally will fill up with a little bit of fluid, and kind of has off and on throughout that 6-year period. Not all the time, but it feels real tight when it's flexed.
So when they went in 6 years ago, apparently you were having some symptoms.
Yeah, I had quite a bit of knee pain again, and they did a meniscus. Said I had another meniscus. tear and they snipped it out.
Right.
They didn't do anything else to it.
Right. Well, back in the day, people were casted for 8 weeks and immobilized, and now we know that that is very deleterious, so we don't do that anymore. The fact that you are doing as well as you are, I think, is pretty commendable. The limited range of motion, it sounds like you're limited in bending but not straightening, and it's really important to make sure that you maintain that full knee extension, keep your knee fully straight. You can part with a little bit of flexion and still function quite fine. You don't need your full knee flexion to function for most activities of daily living. You don't need it to ride a bike, things like that. If it's painful to push it into that flexion, I would avoid that. What I would do is I would maintain the range of motion I had. I also think it'd probably be good to see a physical therapist. They may be able to manually mobilize your knee a little bit more and pick up a little bit more of that flexion, and also make some exercise recommendations for you.
Yeah, chances are when you were immobilized for that 8 or 9 weeks, you had pretty significant deterioration of your articular cartilage. So you accelerated the arthritis process in there, and you're seeing the effects of that now. So now, from here on forward, we're treating your knee like a pretty degenerative knee. You have meniscal tears, chances are your articular cartilage is softened and fibrillated and things like that. And when you get that swelling, that's a sign that your knee is not tolerating whatever you're doing to it. So if you can see any pattern to that swelling and what your activity has been, you need to monitor that. And as Jill said, you needed to hang on to whatever range you have. You know, you may or may not have a knee replacement in your future. If you start to lose that extension, like she said, that can be devastating. So really hang on to that to the best of your ability. And a PT can show you some strategies to help do that. So a visit or two, I think, would really be useful for you to maintain the long-term health of that knee.
Good luck with that, Mike. And Mike actually brought up yoga, and I was already planning on bringing that up, but it's a good time to do it. Thursday at 11, we'll be talking with the author of Pick Your Yoga Practice. She goes through a variety of different styles of yoga and helps people decide which might be the best for them. I was curious whether the two of you recommend yoga and what the benefits might be.
Yeah, I often recommend yoga to my patients. It's good for core strength. Mm-hmm. It's good for mobility. It's good for stability. It's good for relaxation and learning about breathing techniques. It's good for a lot of different issues that people might have. And so we make recommendations for that often.
And a good yoga instructor is very helpful in modifying any activities or any poses that are difficult for you. So don't think that, oh, I can't do that pose, I can't do that type of yoga. Most people are really good at finding ways to modify those activities, which is really important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They kind of start from where you're at.
Right.
One of the issues for any kind of class, not just yoga, and this points again to the importance of a good teacher, is to not compare yourself to the peers in your class. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you see somebody next to you and you say, well, gee, she looks like 10 years older than me. I should be able to do that. And you try to do stuff that your body is not yet ready for, perhaps not understanding that that person may have been doing yoga or whatever your class is for 10 years or more. Mm-hmm. So,
and also, I think there can be a difference for men and women as well. And
absolutely.
And men have a lot of challenges with flexibility.
Obviously. Yes. Yes. Yeah. They sure do. And for example, in my body pump class, my weightlifting class, of course, men are able to lift a lot more weight. So I've given up trying to lift as much as they have. Like Lori has, I was a little upset when people were lifting more weight than I was, and I got competitive and I paid for it. So I learned my own lesson the hard way.
The two of you competitive? I just don't see that. No, but it is really true. And you can tell a good teacher because they will say, mm-hmm. you know, so this is the basic pose. If you want to challenge yourself a little bit, you can try this. Or mm-hmm. if you need, you know, to have less pressure on your knee or your wrist, mm-hmm. try this. And so really you can, if they're good and if they're really thinking about the students, mm-hmm. they encourage you to make it your own.
Right.
Absolutely. So. And I always tell people to err on the conservative side. So it may not feel bad now, but you may be really sore tomorrow. So just err on the conservative side, pick the lower level of the skill or the activity and see how you do. That way you're able to come back a couple days later and do the class again mm-hmm. versus being so sore you have to take a whole week off. And then you have to start right. over, right. all over again.
I'm counting on yoga to keep me upright as an older person.
Yes, yes
I agree.
It's really good for balance. I used to have horrible balance, and yoga mm-hmm. has really improved that.
Yeah, just as an example, I work out pretty much every day of my life. And I got a yoga DVD thinking, okay, I'm going to start some yoga. Well, I couldn't do more than 15 minutes. And I said to myself, okay, the competitive side of me says, what do you mean I can't do this? I want to keep going. And I said to myself, I can't do this because tomorrow I'm really going to hurt. Mm-hmm. So
yep. you have to be smart.
You have to be smart.
You had to treat yourself like someone you were yeah. actually doing physical therapy with instead of yourself. Yeah. Well, you can join in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send a email to talk@wpr.org or post a question or comment on our Facebook page. Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum are guests today. And let's go back to the phones and Kim in Milwaukee. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Oh, my gosh. Hi. I wanted to ask, about a month and a half ago, I was in a bad accident, like the end of January. I was in a bad accident. I hit a wall going I slipped on some ice and hit a wall going about 55 miles an hour. The airbag deployed. I'm 26, so I'm not really used to limited mobility. So it's been really difficult for me to do that. I've been seeing a chiropractor, and I'm wondering, just how much longer am I going to have limited mobility?
Where is your mobility limited?
My back.
Your
mostly.
Back? So you're having back pain that stays in your back and you can't move?
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I'm sorry. And it has more to do with I can't go running and I can't do yoga and
okay.
all the things that I really am going to want to do pretty soon.
Okay, well, if you haven't seen a physical therapist, that's where I would recommend you go next. It's been a month and a half, and so you're really into that phase where you need to start resuming some activity, and a physical therapist can direct you to that. You might start with some simple core strengthening exercises to see how your back tolerates certain loads. So they tend to be very directed and specific about how they give you exercises to load your back in certain ways to prepare it for the kinds of things you want to do, whether it's impact or yoga or whatever, and then gradually transition those specific exercises into those functional kinds of activities. And then hopefully at the end, when you're discharged, then you are discharged to those activities that you want to do. But they really help bridge the gap from where you are now, as in, I can't do these things at all, and boom, getting you back to where you want to go. It's not just you wake up one day and you can do those things, whereas yesterday you couldn't.
Right. And I'm guessing, you know, with the accident being 6 weeks ago, you've started to lose some strength. So getting you on a good specific strengthening program, you know, postural awareness, things like that is going to be a really good strategy for you. You know, you're young and you should recover or be able to gain your strength relatively quickly. So like Lori said, getting on a good program would be a great strategy. Mostly they'd be exercises that you could do at home. So I don't believe it would require a lot of PT visits, but be good things you can do at home.
All right. Thanks for that call, Kim. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Listener Leslie wanted to know the name of the challenging yoga video.
It's a Jillian Michaels kind of Jillian Michaels.
Right.
For those people who know her, it's a
hardcore
yeah. yoga.
Did you say is it power yoga? Or
I don't
know.
It doesn't
or just
say
punishing
it.
Yoga.
It's just punishing yoga.
Well,
yeah,
you
exactly.
said it's actually a harder yeah. workout than the abs.
Than the abs. Yeah, than the abs workout that I got to trying yeah. to do more stuff at home.
But there are a whole yeah, variety of yoga videos yeah, out there.
It was a lot of weight bearing and holding, a lot of weight bearing and plank kinds of mm-hmm. positions, raising a leg, raising an arm, and holding a lot of stuff. It wasn't like I think of yoga as a flexibility base. This was more a core,
like an isometric hold,
isometric holding
stabilization
kind of
type.
Yeah.
It looks like you were having a little flashback.
I was having a flashback. Yes,
yeah. She had a very visceral response.
Yes, yes. Susan on Facebook said, I have been walking for years and noticed this year I've been experiencing a pain below my right kneecap. It comes and goes during a 4-mile walk. Can you help me?
I'm not sure if Susan means right below her kneecap or on the underside of her kneecap. So there's two different things we could be thinking about. If it's right under her kneecap, it could be a little bit of patellar tendinosis where she's irritated the actual tendon. And that could be resolved with some stretching and some really good strengthening from a physical therapist. If it's truly on the under surface of her kneecap, more patellofemoral pain, what we call, that would probably respond as well to some exercises provided by a physical therapist, probably a little bit more in the realm of flexibility and making sure that her alignment is appropriate.
And stuff for the patellofemoral pain, we tend to direct treatment a lot at the hip.
That's right. Mm. So, especially for women, there's been more and more evidence showing that a weak hip is strongly correlative of patellofemoral pain. So weak core, weak gluteus medius, all those things really fit in nicely with patellofemoral pain.
And to me, the other thing that's interesting about this kind of a situation is she's walking, a bilateral activity.
Right.
Why is she having problems on one side and not the other? So I'd want to sit down with her and look and see if she has a subtle leg length difference, if she's got a pelvic asymmetry that might be overloading or corrected with an orthotic or a lift, or if she's always walking on one side of the road where one leg becomes effectively longer than the other. Those are all contributory factors, and you can focus on the knee and strengthen and stretch all around it, but if you don't treat the underlying cause and figure out what caused it in the first place, it's just going to come back.
Right. And if you're walking indoors on a track and you walk, for example, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, well, it's nice they alternate the track route every other day, but that means you walk the same direction if you walk 3 days a week. So those are the kind of little subtle factors that could be contributing to her pathology that a physical therapist would be able to sort through.
Great information. Let's go back to the phones and Sally in Madison. Hi, Sally.
Hello. Last year I learned that I needed to do trochanteric stretches for my right hip. But for a long time, I have been, like 2 or 3 years, I've been waking up with pain in my right calf that it's a cramp, and I have to spend a minute or two for the most time stretching it out. Is there anything to eliminate that?
Well, the big question is what is causing the leg cramp? And here we are with that same question. You're getting a cramp in one leg. Mm-hmm. Why are you getting a cramp in one leg in 2 to 3 years? Have you spoken with your doctor about this?
No, I always forget because it's daytime and I'm...
Right. The things that cause leg cramps, lack of water, potassium, we look at dietary stuff. The other thing is you could have what we call some claudication that comes from your spine where you're getting some occlusion of the neurovascular bundle that goes into that leg.
What does occlusion mean?
Occlusion, blockage. So some people who have atherosclerosis have that. Sometimes people who have spine-related problems will get cramps at night because of how they're positioned at night. It cuts off the neurovascular supply, and so then they get cramping. And they usually get better if they sit up and dangle their legs or get up and move a little bit, it returns. So, again, the treatment would be directed at whatever is the cause of it, and there's a whole list of potential factors that could cause that. So starting with your physician to rule out metabolic things and dietary things, and then going from there to look at some musculoskeletal.
Yeah, I would definitely, especially if the leg that is cramping is also the leg that you had the greater trochanteric bursitis on, because many times that greater trochanteric bursitis is also referred from your back. Mm. So if you can, try and when you wake up with this leg cramp, pay attention to what position you're sleeping in. If you're on a certain side every time, which could be occluding your back, something like that. And I don't know if you can, but that would be a good strategy, and that would be very helpful information to give to your physician. He may be able to help rule in or rule out if it's coming from your back.
One other thing, when I went last time to get an orthotic in my shoe, I had great pain after a week or two from the new orthotic, and I went back and he saw the first time that my one leg, that this leg was a little bit like a half inch longer than my other leg, which I'd never known before. Mm-hmm. Can even a half inch make such a difference?
Mm-hmm. Actually, a half inch is pretty significant.
Yes. Yeah. It's stuff that's a quarter inch or less, there's so much measurement error, unless you're measured with radiographs. There's so much measurement error in measuring leg length that we don't sweat a quarter inch. But a half an inch is usually a true leg length, although it could also be coming, again, from a pelvic obliquity.
Right.
It might not be an actual leg length difference, but it could be a rotation in your pelvis that's making an apparent leg length difference that isn't true. That should be addressed. And again, a physical therapist would be able to take a look at that. I'd start with somebody who specializes in spine and go from there.
All right. Thanks for that call, Sally. And you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We are visiting with physical therapists Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. They are happy to answer your questions about getting in shape, and staying injury-free. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with physical therapists Jill Tyne Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne Brody about how to prevent or recover from aches, pains, strains, and sprains. And we will go right back to the phones. And Winnie in Milwaukee is up next. Hi, Winnie.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. Yeah, I have a question. I took Cipro antibiotic back in early June for urinary tract infection, and I also had ankle surgery to remove hardware that was in my ankle from a broken ankle. And as I recovered from the surgery and then tried to recover enough to go on a dive trip in late July, I took the boot off after the recovery and tried to work out by just walking. And I had been going through physical therapy also. And then I developed the foot doctor said tarsal tunnel syndrome.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Basically, I guess, like tendonitis. That took a couple weeks to almost a month to recover from it, so I ended up missing my dive trip. And I was upset about it. Then that went away, and now since about January, I've had like tendonitis in my wrist, my left wrist, and trouble with it. And I'm wondering, on the label of the Cipro, it says tendonitis and that tendon issues can be a problem. But when I went to the doctor and she asked her about it, she goes, oh, no, that there isn't any relation. You're just getting old. I'm 60.
well, let's see what Lori and Jill have to say about that. Lori?
Well, there is a relationship between Cipro and tendinopathies or tendon ruptures. It's been reported by the FDA. Does it affect everybody? Certainly not. And you may have had the perfect storm of the surgery on your ankle in combination with the Cipro that maybe set you up to have symptoms. Tarsal tunnel is not the same as a tendonitis.
Right.
Just for the record, if you've heard of carpal tunnel, where the nerve gets entrapped in your wrist and you get numbness in your fingers, the tarsal tunnel is the foot version of that.
Hmm.
So that's a different issue. But it's certainly, there has been a relationship with tendinopathies and tendonitises, and particularly in the Achilles. And again, it may have been just the perfect storm for you of the those two factors coming together at once.
Right. I feel like we can kind of have a little bit of cause and effect at the ankle with your surgery, being in a boot and being on Cipro and having a little bit of tendinopathy there. But did you do anything in January that you can remember that would have created your wrist pain? Or did that just come out of the blue? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, I'm left-handed, and it's in my left hand.
Okay.
I have an old, like when I was 9 years old, I fell and fractured, you know, both of my wrists.
Okay.
So I don't. But.
But did you do more activity in January? Did you do a lot of holiday baking that used your hands, or do a lot of writing, for example, handwriting notes, or crocheting, or knitting, or anything like that that could have kind of triggered this?
Well, what probably triggered it, it actually is probably more in November it started. I have a pear tree, and I was canning pears.
Oh, mm-hmm.
So it was probably from peeling pears.
Okay, that would definitely do it.
That could be. Was there a partridge in that pear tree? I'm sorry, I just couldn't help myself.
You
it was Christmas time. I couldn't help myself. Sorry. Yeah, so, you know, when we can point to sort of an etiology or an inciting event, then we say, well, it probably is mechanical and sort of the cumulative stress. When you can't think of absolutely anything you've done and it just drops in out of the sky, out of the blue, then we start looking for other causes. But, you know, if you were doing a lot of activity with that wrist and hand, it may have just set the stage or kind of primed the pump for the onset of that. If you didn't have sufficient recovery time or treatment of that when it started.
And just looking at some of the information available online, it sounds like Cipro can have that effect when you're taking it, but it sounds like the wrist issue was quite a bit after.
Yeah, it sounds like, I don't know that that would be associated with the Cipro. That's why I was kind of wondering if there was a mechanism.
All right, well, good luck with that, Winnie. Let's go next to Judith in Muskego. Hi, Judith.
Hello. I had a recommendation for those people who have back and core problems. I've had a tremendously long history with my back. I'm 65 years old, and I've done well with this. It's called Allaire Back Fitness Program, and it's on public TV in Milwaukee, Monday to Friday at 7:30. And I really like this show. First of all, you can watch it for free, but I bought the three-disc DVD thing. What's so nice about her is that she doesn't have you do lots and lots of repetitions. She modifies as you go along, and she tells you why the exercise is good for a particular effect for your back. It's, you know, a lot of it's core training. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you guys are familiar with this show.
I'm not familiar with that show. I don't, to the best of my knowledge, it's not.
We pulled it up on the internet and we're looking at it. Mm-hmm. And I like all the comments you made about she's instructing you why you're doing the exercises and kind of the benefits of the exercises. That's really important. And having education about how to modify the exercises is really good. So if you found something that's a good fit for you, it sounds like it fits into your routine really well. That's a wonderful strategy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that some of the important points are, you know, you found something that works for you. Is this going to be the answer for everybody with back pain? Well, certainly not. There are other people who need a different strategy. Many times these kinds of exercises require you to get, for example, up and down off the floor. There are some people who just can't do that or are in too much pain to lay on the floor or because of their knees or hips can't get up and down off the floor. So everyone needs to find something that works for them, that they can physically do, and that they enjoy. Right. You know, if Judith didn't enjoy this exercise, she wouldn't continue to do it.
Right.
So you need to find something that you like and that works for you.
As Lori always says, know thyself.
Know thyself.
Don't say that?
Yes, you do.
Oh, okay.
Because you're so wise.
It comes with age. Jinx.
Well, thank you for that, Judith. And for those of you that might not have caught it earlier, Jill and Lori are sisters. And so you can hear some of the sibling relationships right here that we're all an audience to. Well, let's go back to the phones and Sherry in Superior. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have my right ankle gets disjointed every once in a while. It happened last week where I slipped on the ice and my ankle was sort of disjointed for, it was turned inwards, my whole foot, for about 2 minutes and then it pops out. It's very painful during that time, but after it pops back into joint, I'm able to walk and put weight on it. And the history is that I broke it when I was 12, and I've rolled it a lot since then.
Mm-hmm.
But now about 2 years ago, it started becoming disjointed. Mm-hmm. And I know it's a loose ligament, mm-hmm. and I've tried exercises. But what do you have for advice for me?
It sounds to me like you have what we call a little, it's subluxus. So it kind of slides out of place, but then it kind of slides back after a couple minutes on its own. And it sounds like with your history of having some fractures and then a very, very loose ankle, that all makes sense. We have lots of ligaments that are very small around our ankle that offer us stability. And my best guess is those are really stretched and or torn for you. So as a consequence of that, your static stabilizers are kind of shot, and you need to rely a little bit more heavily on what we call your dynamic stabilizers or your muscles around your ankle joint. So have you seen a physical therapist at all for this?
I was going to, but there's always, you know, I have a high deductible insurance, so it costs a lot of money to do that.
Right, right. Well, I'm thinking if you can even see a physical therapist one or two times for some interventions and exercises they can give you at home, particularly things working on kind of balance and proprioception, where you are on an uneven surface and you kind of train your muscles how to kind of correct your malpositions, I think that would be a great strategy. You're going to benefit from something along those lines.
Yeah, the history for people with chronic ankle instability is not good. I mean, people who have this recurrent spraining and instability tend to have a lot of problems down the line. So learning some strategies that you can use and use them every day to help strengthen and help with your balance will help. You could also think about getting a brace for high demand situations. You don't want to wear the brace all the time, but only when you're in kind of at-risk activities. And it doesn't replace the need for those balance exercises, because when you get out of the bed in the middle of the night to use the bathroom or whatever, you're going to sprain your ankle because you don't have the muscles trained. So both of those pieces happen together to help with that.
Okay.
All right.
All
right. Thanks for that, Sherry, and good luck with that. Let's go next to Cheryl in Fond du Lac. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi.
Hi.
I commute a lot. I'm in the car an hour in the morning and an hour late in the afternoon. I sit a lot at work because of the nature of my job. I have gotten a standing workstation, so that helps some. But I have a chronic issue with my right hip, and I think it's from the accelerator
mm-hmm.
of the car. I try to use cruise control as much as possible, but that's not always possible when you're trying to drive safely. So any recommendations for chronic hip issues?
Is it an automatic car or a manual transmission?
It's automatic.
One of the first things, this is not uncommon, and you are, like you said, you do sit a lot. You're sitting in your car. You're sitting at work. I think it's great that you have a workstation where you can stand up and change your position throughout the day. Obviously, you can't do that in your car. I would take a very close look at your seat in your car and see if it, sometimes bucket seats will irritate you a little bit, and they'll kind of put your hip in a little bit of a position, kind of a funky position. Also, make sure that you don't have anything in your back pocket on that side to make sure you're not sitting on anything that's changing your pelvic alignment in your car seat.
Yeah. Is it really just in your car seat, or do you have it when you sit at work or sit at home?
It's worse in the car.
Okay.
And I notice it's worse if I cross my legs.
Okay. And does it stay in your hip, or does it travel at all?
Just in the hip.
Just in the hip. Okay. Yeah. So I agree with Jill. I'd look at my seat. You may need to get some kind of a modification of your seat. You can try a cushion.
Mm-hmm.
Again, particularly because those bucket seats tend to be sloped on the sides, and they tend to push your hips in and roll them in. So if you lift yourself up a little bit, you can also try a lumbar roll, which may position your pelvis a little bit differently and shift your weight off of your ischial tuberosities a little bit. So just that subtle shift in your pelvic position may make a difference as well. you know, if those things aren't working, I go in to see somebody and who might be able to look at you and help you with a little bit more precise positioning, as well as some strengthening exercises. Mm-hmm. Usually strengthening your glutes can help a tremendous amount with this kind of hip pain.
And Lori, when you were talking about the lumbar support.
The lumbar roll.
Yeah.
You can roll up a towel, a hand towel, and put it across the little curve of your back. I know many newer cars have a lumbar support, but I haven't found any that are very good.
Right.
You know, they're not much of a support. You should normally have a little bit of a curve in your low back. So the seats generally don't have quite enough.
Right. And the other thing is if you might need to move your seat up a little bit. If you're reaching for the gas pedal all the time, that can kind of change your hip mechanics as well. So I would encourage you to scoot your seat up a tiny bit, scoot your butt back in the seat as far as it can, and use that lumbar roll. And that sitting upright posture may help you a little bit.
And Cheryl said that she tries to use the cruise control as much as she can.
It's great.
Lori, you want to say why that's a good idea?
Well, because it effectively brings the seat closer, as Jill just said, so you don't have that long reach. And again, if you have your left leg kind of resting on the floor and then you're reaching with the right one, it creates a torsion in your pelvis, and that long reach is going to put stress on your hip.
And you can also shift around a little
bit. Right, exactly. Stretch your leg out a little bit.
All right, good luck with that, Cheryl. We have just a minute or so before the news. Cheryl also mentioned a standing desk. Mm-hmm. And why is that a good idea, Jill?
Well, staying in one position for a prolonged period of time, regardless of what it is not good for our bodies. So a desk that allows you to sit for a little bit and then stand for a little bit helps you load your joints differently, takes some load off your back. They're really nice things. There's actually desks now that come on treadmills.
Yes. Mm-hmm. One of our coworkers has one at home, not
yes.
here.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I would use one.
I'd like one too.
Me
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
Well, we have a lot more to talk about with Jill Tine-Nissenbaum and Lori Tine-Brody, but it is time to take a quick look at the news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network. Nothing can ruin fun activities more than a sore back or painful muscles. Once a month, we are fortunate to have folks with us who know a lot about staying in good shape and getting back in shape after an injury. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for spending your Monday with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jill Tine-Nissenbaum is an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison and a staff physical therapist for UW Athletics and Badger Sports Medicine. Thanks again for being with us today, Jill.
Happy to be here.
And Lori Tine-Brody is a physical therapist and athletic trainer with the UW Sports Medicine and Spine Center. She's also the graduate program director for the Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions in Provo, Utah. Great to have you with us, Lori, too.
Good to be here.
And tell us just a little bit about the Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions.
Well, Jill is one of their
I'm a graduate of the program.
Alumni.
There you go.
Let me just step back and say
when Lori was grad, so she was the graduate program director for the program I went through. So it was a little nepotistic. We had to make many accommodations.
Yes.
However, she was looking at the curriculum and she said, well, what do you think about this in the curriculum? What do you think about this in the curriculum? What do you think? And I said, do you just want me to enroll in your program and go through it and give you some feedback? So that's what I ended up doing.
Yeah,
so that was why I'm an alumni.
There you go.
So we educate healthcare professionals. We provide generally doctorate degrees. So the program Jill went through was in orthopedic and sports science, and it's for practicing physical therapists. It's a limited residency program, so you do a portion online, and then you come to Utah and do a portion face-to-face. And you have a dissertation and so on and so forth. So I chair the program in orthopedic and sports science.
Great. Well, let's go back to the phones. And Esther in West Allis is up. Hi, Esther.
Hello.
Hi.
I was diagnosed with a torn rotator cuff. And an EMG showed no neuropathy in the ulnar nerve. And I have a burning pain from my elbow down to my wrist. Does this make sense?
The classic conventional wisdom is pain that originates in your shoulder, as in a rotator cuff, won't go past your elbow. Mm-hmm. So any kind of burning, type of pain in your forearm is coming from your neck, typically. Or you could have something entrapped at your elbow. Mm-hmm. So you said your ulnar nerve was fine?
They said there's no neuropathy in the ulnar nerve.
In the ulnar nerve, okay. Well, there are your ulnar nerve is not the only nerve in your forearm. There's the radial nerve, the median nerve. So there's other nerves there that could be entrapped somewhere around your elbow or in your neck. So I would continue looking for the cause of those symptoms.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Esther.
Good luck.
Good luck with that. We had an email from Vicky. She says, I guess I spend too much time on the internet. I'm suffering from terrible shoulder and neck pain from using the computer mouse. Pain radiates from my neck down the shoulder to the upper arm while using the mouse. Help.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so what she's doing is probably making it worse by continuing to surf on the internet.
Poor right. thing. And email us.
Yes. So, but that is not uncommon to have your pathology start in your neck and have your symptoms kind of manifest all the way down your arm. If she has not seen a physical therapist, I would encourage her to do so because there are many postural type exercises, ways that you can actually unload your cervical spine a little bit to unload the compression on the nerve that would help her hand. The other option is there's lots of different modifications you can do to mousing and keyboard setup and things like that. So making sure that her chair is aligned appropriately, that her screen is an appropriate distance away so she's not, you know, kind of leaning forward to look at the computer monitor, that can be a factor. Perhaps she needs glasses to see the computer monitor and, you know, she just shouldn't lean forward so far. The three of us are looking at each other and smiling as we say that.
Because we all are, reading glass wearers.
Victims of that. That's
right.
Exactly. Right.
But those are all good strategies. And again, going back to that original conversation that you have to take care of the cause of the problem. So if the cause is her setup with her computer, those things can be modified. If the problem is the amount of time she spends there, well, then that's something to have a conversation about as well. And we can talk about strategies because there are people who work at a computer and have to be at one all day. Right. So it's not like we haven't encountered this problem before. And that's where some of the strengthening and unloading things that Jill talked about can come in.
Lori, do I remember from past shows that the suggestion was made, even though it's not easy to do, but actually to start mousing with your other hand?
Mm-hmm. You can do that, but again, you have to be careful because that's like starting any new activity.
Right.
This is going to be very novel for the other side, and you can create the same cluster of symptoms on the other side. So yes.
But even things as simple as making sure her computer's not off to the side and she's looking directly on it can make changes. So looking at her computer station is a good idea for her.
Good place to start. Good luck with that, Vicky. Let's go back to the phones and Kurt in Minneapolis. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, how's it going?
Good.
About 2 years ago, I was on mission in Iraq, and I sustained a left knee injury. I had a really sharp pop in my knee, and I could feel a jolt down my leg. I went back to base and had it, you know, looked at. I guess I didn't have any X-rays done, but it was just summed up as a general knee injury. And I was given 2 weeks of a medical profile where I didn't do anything. Once I got off that two-week profile, like the day I got off, I ended up going right back into all the physical work. I wasn't restricted at all, so they made me do everything. And I started noticing that there's a really sharp pain in my right knee now, and there was no injury sustained. So I was wondering if it was, you know, maybe compensating.
Absolutely.
Or
yeah, I think you're right on the money. So it sounds like you were kind of shut down for a couple of weeks, and I don't know if you had any rehab or exercises, but basically you went from 0 to 60 in one day. And to kind of compensate for your pain you had in your left knee, you overused your right side. So that is not uncommon at all. You know, to get rid of your right knee pain, we need to examine your left knee and see what the root of the problem is.
Yeah. Have you seen anybody for both of your knees since you've been back?
I did talk to the VA about my right, about both knees. They didn't say anything about my left knee. My right knee, they technically diagnosed me. I mean, I don't know how they worked it out, but they came up with the conclusion that it's osteoarthritis in my right knee.
Okay.
But all they ever did was an X-ray, and I've been told that you can't determine tissue injuries through an X-ray.
Well, if you have arthritis, you can see that on an x-ray. And, for example, in your knee, it's identified by narrowing of your joint space. Usually you would compare it to the opposite knee, but there's also kind of standards where they can see that. There's sometimes spurring on the edge of your joint. So they're called Fairbanks changes, and they're seen on a radiograph. There's four specific things that you look for. So they can make that call for arthritis on a standard radiograph. Did they do anything about it?
No, they actually nothing being done about it.
Well,
I haven't moved into a treatment phase at all yet.
It's
been 2 years, and I just finally had in October, my disability claim finally went through for it.
Okay.
Now I can actually start getting care.
Okay, yeah, it's time to do that. You need to see a physical therapist, get on a strengthening program. If your knee's bothering you quite a bit, in the meantime, you can get in a pool and do walking in a pool, you know, to start to strengthen your legs in an environment that doesn't put so much weight on your joint.
Okay.
So, but I would get into some physical therapy, get a decent exam.
For both knees.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Get them both looked at.
Good luck with that, Kurt. Let's go back to the phones and Bill in Plover. Hi, Bill.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay, my question is, I was diagnosed and treated for arthritis in my right foot, and they fused the joint in my big toe there, and I've been a runner for over 40 years, and they kind of, at the time, said, well, you might want to consider, you know, not running. But anyway, I like to run, so now I run, like, strictly on grass. In the winter, I run on an indoor track that's fairly soft. You know, I wear really good shoes and all that. But, you know, my feet get fairly numb, and, you know, sometimes they're sore than other times. But I just continue to run, and I guess I'm wondering, am I actually doing any more harm? It seems like when I lay off and just bicycle, they're still fairly numb and sore, so I'm not sure it's any worse when I run, but I'm just wondering what your thoughts were.
Is it both feet?
It's in both feet now. The left foot has never gotten so bad that I had the joint fused like the right foot was.
Okay. Well, numbness is not a typical symptom with arthritis. So it's one thing to have arthritis and have your toe fused, but the numbness is a separate issue. Do you have any other underlying medical conditions, diabetes or anything like that, neuropathy?
Not that I've ever been, you know, told or, you know, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. And do you get the numbness only when you run or bike?
Well, I guess it's kind of there all the time, you know. It's a little bit sore, and maybe I'm not using the word numbness correctly, but I guess it's just a little bit sore all the time.
Well,
and if I overdo it with the running or whatever, then it'll be more sore the next day. Then it goes away, and
yeah, I would have it checked out. Like Lori said, the numbness isn't commonly associated with osteoarthritis or pain in your joints. So especially to have it in both feet is a little concerning. So I would make sure that you're not having some changes in sensation in your feet because you're at risk for, you know, injuring the bottom of your foot and things like that. I think I would probably bring this up with your physician and discuss it with him or her.
Yeah, I mean, numbness is a pretty straightforward symptom, you know, where you can't feel your feet. That's pretty different from pain, which is clearly pain.
So do you have numbness, Bill?
Well, I guess it's not really numb as much as it is just kind of sore. Maybe sore is a better word for it. And it's not painful. It's just some days it's more sore than others. But it seems like sore.
Okay, well, soreness is not an uncommon symptom with arthritis, and it tends to be related to activity levels. So if you're more active and running and you get more sore, then one would be inclined to say that's a typical symptom of arthritis. So are you making it worse? You know, who knows? I guess the one thing I'd say is to make sure you wear good shoes. Make sure that your shoes have a pretty good heel on them because you're going to want your heel elevated a little bit because you don't have the motion in your big toe. And I would avoid running uphill. because that's going to require greater motion in your foot and ankle that you don't have.
Right. The concern with that is just changing your gait mechanics and will and you know compensating at another joint and potentially making another joint sore. So the modifications that Lori talked about will help kind of prevent that. You know, you could also do some cross training. I think biking, as you mentioned, is a great strategy. The other thing that would be great for you would be swimming, getting in a pool.
Yeah.
Be wonderful.
Yeah.
All right. Good luck with that, Bill, and give us an update.
Yeah, it's a pretty typical thing. If you lose motion at a joint, no matter what joint it is, if you continue your same activities, you have to compensate somewhere. You have to get that motion from another joint. And whether or not that joint is able to tolerate that load is unknown.
It's just robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Right.
We had an email from Jennifer. She says, I started the Insanity workout and did fine for the first 2 to 3 weeks, but now I'm experiencing pretty severe leg pain from the calf to the ankle. I had runner's knee a few years ago and was diagnosed with runner's knee or IBAN syndrome. This feels much different than runner's knee, but don't know where to go from here. And Jill, why don't you let people know what the aptly named Insanity program is?
Well, the Insanity workout, and again, they're on DVD, and so I think a lot of people have this false pretense that, oh, if I do it at home, it's not going to be that difficult. And nothing could really be further from the truth, particularly with the Insanity workout. It's very high-level, intense exercise, and you do a bout of it. You do the same exercise for 20, 30, or 45 seconds, and then you get a brief recovery, and then you go on to your next exercise. So it's basically very, very high intensity bursts for, like I said, up to 30 to 45 seconds.
And the description says the plan involves a rigorous schedule of 6 days of exercise per week, and each workout will take approximately 30 to 60 minutes to complete. And as you said, it's at extremely high intensity.
It is. It is a very high intensity workout. And so what it sounds like with Jennifer, potentially, it sounds like she got a little bit of almost Achilles tendonitis. It's in the back of her calf, from her calf to the ankle. Oh, even if it's in the front, it could be a little bit of medial tibial stress syndrome. So a lot of these require impact, and it's a lot of jumping, hopping, leaping, skipping type of things. And, you know, people think, oh, I'm doing it at home. How hard can it be? Well, it can be really hard, and particularly it depends on what surface she's on. So if she's doing it on hardwood floors or tile versus a carpeted area. And just like anywhere else, you need to go into it kind of slowly. It sounds like this is an overuse type of injury.
It could also be a stress fracture.
It could. Mm.
So I'd probably get it checked out. I mean, it's one thing to have calf pain and Achilles tendonitis, which is pretty, you know, clearly associated in your Achilles, or medial tibial stress syndrome, as Jill talked about, which is usually pretty confined to the lower third of your calf. But when she's talking about severe pain from the calf to the ankle, to me, that's a red flag that something's amiss. And given the impact that Jill mentioned with this, it's not unusual that she could have a stress fracture. So I'd get it checked out before I did anything else.
All right. Thanks for that email, Jennifer. Let's go back to the phones and Kim in Fountain City. Hi, Kim.
Hello.
Hi.
I broke my radius bone in my forearm right near the wrist back in the 10th of January. I was skiing and I crashed and burned, and the strap of my pole hyperextended my wrist upward or backward or whatnot. And I had a retired doctor friend check it out that day, and we didn't feel any hot spots or anything, so we just thought I had a very bad sprain. Well, after about 3 weeks, I had it x-rayed, and yes, I had broken it. But the doctor said the good news was it was a good, clean break, and it was healing nicely. Well, it's been, 9 weeks now, and I'm not wearing the brace all the time, but it's swollen quite a bit, especially underneath the wrist and on top of the wrist, and the loss of motion is not coming back, and I'm concerned what should I be doing? What's my next step? Who do I go see?
Right. So, you know, if your fracture is healed and that's all stable, it's certainly time to have physical therapy, or in this case, it could be occupational therapy, start performing rehabilitation with you. There are people who are called certified hand therapists who specialize in the upper extremity and the wrist in particular, wrist and hand in particular, and seeing either a PT or an OT who are a certified hand therapist would be very beneficial to you. They can mobilize the joint around there and provide you with the strengthening and range of motion program so you can regain function in your wrist.
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly what I do. And you have to remember that if you fell hard enough to break your, to fracture your bone, that you had pretty significant trauma to your wrist as well. It was just overshadowed by the fracture. So now the fracture's healing, and now you really need to deal with all the soft tissue damage that happened at the time of your fall.
Oh, okay. Okay. Do I need to be referred by my regular doctor for this, or can I just call up and make an appointment?
Well, in the state of Wisconsin, you do not need a referral to see a physical therapist. However, most insurance companies do require it. So you could call your local physical therapist, and they'd be able to answer that question for you.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for that call, Kim. And Lee in Milwaukee is up next. Hi, Lee.
Hi. I have a cartilage, thinning cartilage in the inner side of each knee, and I wondered, is there any exercise or supplement or anything that could help to keep that from going bone on bone?
Oh, I love that question. Mm-hmm. That's a
great
that's,
question.
That's like my soapbox question.
There we go.
Are there things,
Lori? Step up.
Right. I'm just going to take my headset off now.
Let her go nuts.
Oh, feel free to jump in. But don't hurt yourself.
Okay.
All right. So yes. Well, first of all, if you're bowed legged, that's going to be a risk factor. There's not anything you can do about that at this point in time. But know that it will increase your risk unless you want to have a tibial osteotomy.
No. Other than what about a lateral wedge?
Yes. Oh, well,
in your shoe.
I know that though. Yes, you could put a lateral wedge in your shoe. It has to be a certain number of degrees. So sometimes wedging your shoe can help, and a physical therapist should be able to determine if that works for you or doesn't work for you. There's also unloading braces that will unload that compartment of your knee. Other than that, keeping your weight down is really important because every pound of body weight is 2 to 3 pounds across your knee joint. If you are bowed legged, it's going to be even more than that. You need to stay active. That means exercise, but avoiding a lot of impacting. That means jumping and things like that. Walking should be okay, but you need to wear shoes that have good shock absorption. And if you can walk on a dirt trail or a track that has some cushion or give to it, that would be helpful. Keeping your core muscles, including your hips, your glutes, and your quadriceps strong is really important because those are your primary shock absorbers of your knee. So if your quads and glutes are not functioning well, then they will increase the load across your knee. And then in addition to that, there's some question about nutrients and whether antioxidants such as vitamin C are helpful. It's being debated right now in the literature. So, but glucosamine and chondroitin, that combination tends to help about half the people. Downside being you can't take it if you're allergic to shellfish, and it takes 2 to 3 months to have an effect.
Yeah, so you may want to start with the exercise and all those activities first and see how you do before you throw the nutraceuticals, the glucosamine and chondroitin, especially in combination, into the mix.
Mm-hmm. And if you're having any issues about that, if you're active and not sure what to do, see a physical therapist for 1 or 2 visits, and they can take a look at you, examine your knees, look at your strength in your hips and your glutes, and give you a few things that you can do at home to help keep those muscles strong. To help prevent problems
right
down the road.
It needs to be a kind of a lifestyle change, mm-hmm, or part of your lifestyle, part of your routine to save that articular cartilage.
Yep.
All right. Good question, Lee. And I think Lori was happy to end on that.
Yeah.
Well, as usual, the time just flew by. Jill Tynissenbaum, assistant professor.
Thank you for the promotion.
Yahoo! I'm sure that's official. Assistant professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison and staff physical therapist for UW Athletics and Badger Sports Medicine. Thanks so much.
Go Bucky.
And Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer with UW Sports Medicine and the Spine Center, also with the Rocky Mountain University of Health Professions. Lori, always a pleasure.
Great to be here.
Well, coming up tomorrow, we have a couple, I think, really interesting shows. At 11, we'll talk with the author of a fascinating memoir of being off balance in several ways. It's called Revertigo. And then at 11:45, we'll talk with the author of a different type of memoir. Callan Hardy is the author of My Queer Life, which details his experiences as an out gay man in Wisconsin. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in this week for Larry Miller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.